Okay, here we are, week 9, the third week in the second session. And the theme is space and stories. And that's pretty much it. What I said in the transition, which I realized a lot of you didn't have a chance to see until fairly recently, all of you, I guess, but we'll work with that. What I said in the transition was that we'd be looking at space, at stories and at thoughts. But as I worked with the material, I decided that I was going to have to shift the structure of things a little and talk about thoughts next week because there's just a lot to say. Maybe that's because I think a lot. I don't know. But today we'll focus on stories and then make the transition into thoughts next week. So the story, of course, last week we looked at the story of the self and the world, the self in its world. What TSK calls the founding story. And that's our model, so we'll keep referring back to it. But the idea is that this story structure is really important because it operates at many levels all the time. You could say the founding story, at least most of the time, is always operating. That is, we always have a sense of being a self in the world, in our world, in my world. But there are stories that happen all the time, different kinds of stories, and that's really what we want to be looking at. So I want to say something by way of a kind of a reminder, or maybe this is a good time to clarify a point that I've referred to before, and that is that the way that TSK understands space is so fundamentally different from the way that science understands space. And science in that regard is just a kind of an expression of our everyday understanding of space. Because our everyday understanding of space associates it with the external world. There's some kind of, somebody just got muted, I guess. There's a little noise interference. Well, there it is again. So science sees it that way. The scientific view is that space is what contains physical objects, right? It's the container for the physical world. And when you see it that way, then you can, the next step is to say, and subjective experience isn't as real as that. You know, what's real is what is objects in the world, and then we have our subjective reaction to that somehow. And that is not a scientific view, as I said. It's kind of the ordinary taken-for-granted view, at least in our culture. But when you have that view, then science becomes the highest form of knowledge because science has developed all these really remarkable ways of investigating the things that show up in physical space. So then you give science credit because nobody else has ever done as good a job. You know, we're the guys who invented computers because we understand about how things work, kind of like that. So that's the objective view of space. And the problem with that view is that it's just kind of demonstrably, it seems to me, false. It's not a question of philosophy, and I guess I shouldn't say false, it's incomplete. It's not a question of taking some physical or philosophical stand and talking about materialism versus idealism, which is one of the ways that gets expressed in philosophy. It's not a question of what your theory is about what counts as real. It's just that an objective view like that leaves out the whole world that then gets characterized as subjective, or at least it makes it secondary. The I'm going to give you an example. Well, no, let me go ahead and talk a little more about stories, and then I'll give you an example that may help clarify that. I don't think it needs a lot of clarification because we've talked about it in the past. And as I say, to me, it seems kind of self-evident, but okay. And of course, there are philosophers who make that point or related point in various ways, but still, that's our common sense view. Okay. The reason that that's important is that when you take a broader view of what space is, when you allow for the possibility that space could be more than that, then space can accommodate, can allow the range of human experience. And that's really important for TSK. It's one of the things that TSK insists on, it seems to me. And it's important for us, you know, it's when that is as human beings, because it's when we understand that we're not kind of some secondary event, you know, this subjective reality is this little tail on the body of physical reality. You know, there's actually a famous image. I mean, people would nowadays would say this was overstated, but there is an image that Thomas Huxley, I think, used in the 19th century. He's talking about consciousness, and he said consciousness is like there's a train going down the track, and consciousness is the steam, is the whistle that the train engineer uses to signal where he is. You know, it's just this totally little. Has nothing to do with the operation of the train. It's just this little thing on the side. So that's kind of the extreme view. When you think that way, you really lose the opportunity to say anything of value about our experience. So it's really fundamental to the TSK vision to say that we live not just in a physical universe, you could say, but we live in a world, and, you know, we ourselves living in a world. That's still not, you know, the final word, but it's a way of understanding things that gives us the opportunity to explore. And one of the things that it gives us the opportunity to explore, as we saw last week, is that we live in a meaningful world. And what gives meaning to that world is the story. Right? The world unfolds within a story. There's always a story, you know, our experience is meaningful to us. Even if you say the meaning is that the world is absurd and there is no meaning, you know, kind of an existentialist view, at least in a caricatured form, that's still a meaning. You know, the meaning is the world is meaningless. Even if you say, well, I'm going to operate as a scientist, and I am going to accept this view that the self is a little detour on the way to reality, you're still choosing a particular version. You're still interpreting the world in a certain way or telling a story about the world, you know, the science story. So it's because we live in a meaningful world and the story gives us that meaning that that we can talk about inhabiting the world. You know, this is a theme, I guess it hasn't come up in the last week or two, but the basic idea that, you know, that objects occupy space, but we inhabit space. And the difference between the two, one way of talking about it, is to say that inhabiting space means that space is filled with meaning, is instinct with meaning, to use that word in a kind of an old-fashioned way. It's everywhere you look in the world, there's meaning. You know, you can't get away from it. So that's how it comes to be that we can inhabit the world. That turns out to be tremendously important because when you allow for the realm of meaning in space, you allow for the possibility that you can really change your whole relationship to space and to the world. And that's why you remember way back in week two, I think, in the first course, Klaus called attention to that quote from Sacred Dimensions, where Rinpoche writes, space is the only therapy we need, or space is all the therapy we need. And that's why. It's because once we understand space in this more pervasive way, then everything is open. Everything is available. The story that we understand, the meaning that we assign to the world, the way that we engage the world, whether it's in terms of a self or in some other way, all of that is now available to us. But first you have to open up to space. So that's what it means. And we start off then with the astounding story. But I've been talking more generally now about the nature of stories, okay? So I want to give an example because, well, to help make that clear. But first I'll turn to a comment by Ron. He says, well, that's very interesting regarding meaning because it triggers the instruction in exercise 16 in the TSK book to allow all meanings to be time. And then it considers stories. Let's see. There's something, you mistyped something there. I guess if you consider story, well, I don't know. Anyway, exercises 18 to 22 track how the self is set up and time is relegated to the past, present, future structure, which tones down time. Right. And then if we consider stories, that's what he meant to type. Okay. Which tracks how the self is set up. Well, that's right. It's a really good point. You know, we're focusing on space. I'm not talking too much. Very little really about time, but it is absolutely true that the moment you start talking about the world in terms of meaningful and that meaning is given by a story, you've introduced time. And our ordinary understanding of story, which we can accept for right this moment, is that, you know, stories have to unfold in the past, present, future structure. So yes, we get our ordinary understanding of time as a kind of a structural element in any story. That's right. So I want to give you an example that, if, you know, just in case you're saying, well, I'm not so sure, you know, I think maybe science has the final word on this. I want to give you a very nice example, I think, from a French philosopher, Jean-Paul Sartre, in Being and Nothingness. He's not using it for exactly this purpose, but he talks about going to a cafe and you're expecting to see Pierre at the cafe. It's Pierre because he's in France, right? He's in Paris. You're expecting to see Pierre at the cafe, but he's not there. And the point that Sartre makes is that his absence pervades the space of the cafe. What you see in the cafe is the absence of Pierre. The word that Sartre uses, at least in the English translation, is not pervade, but haunt. He says his absence haunts the cafe, but it's essentially the same thing. And I just happened to be reading something recently which made that much more meaningful, and that is that Sartre was working on Being in Time during Being in Nothingness, during World War II, and he gives the example, or the person I was writing gives the example of how Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir would go to a cafe every day, and there was a time when they would always see these two women who would sit at the table, and then one day they weren't there. And because it was wartime France and you know, the Germans were occupying Paris, there was a real fear that they had somehow just been taken away by the German Gestapo, you know. So it's not just a question of saying, oh, I was going to meet Pierre for a cafe, you know, for coffee, and he's not there. the absence of Pierre may be an extremely meaningful point. But either way, I think the example is really good because it helps show how physical presence in the sense of objects being present is not enough to make sense of our world. The absence of somebody is just as real in terms of the meaning of the world that we inhabit as the presence of somebody. And so I like that example. Okay. So I'm going to skip over a little bit here. So what's important then is to realize that the world that we inhabit is given its meaning through a story. And the tendency is to think of the story as reality. Tendency is maybe not a strong enough word. We generally, whatever world we're inhabiting at the moment, there's a story about it, and the founding story, the founding part of that is here I am, and we accept, really unquestioningly, most of the time, most people, that's the way things are. That's the reality of the situation. But in fact, what happens is that we are constantly switching stories. And given the way we're talking about stories and their relationship to space right now, what you can say is that we're constantly switching spaces. So that shows up in very simple, very trivial ways. Trivial is not such a nice word. We'll look at that in a moment. But I'll give you a more dramatic example. It's possible some of you have heard me use this in the past. But I used to live in a house with a driveway, and I would park my car in the driveway. And one morning I went out to the car in the driveway, and when I went to the driver's side, something was wrong. It took me a moment to realize something was wrong. And I finally realized that the window had been smashed in. And what happened was somebody had stolen the radio from the car. I don't think people do that anymore, but at that time people would steal car radios. So the interesting thing about that was my reaction, which is going to be a little hard to put into words, I guess, but it was the world that I inhabited, the ordinary world in which I get into my car and drive away, was shattered, just like the glass in the window. For a moment, nothing made sense. And then I realized what was going on. I told a new story, right? And the story was, oh, somebody, or maybe I didn't realize exactly right at that moment, but somebody smashed in the window, or at least the window is smashed. But for a moment, it was like the story was gone and there wasn't a new story to replace it. It felt like falling into this abyss, just for a moment, you know. So that's a dramatic example. Probably if you think about it, you can come up with some examples like that for yourselves where there's this radical shift. But most of the time, we do shift spaces, and that's the way I want to talk about it, just because I think it's kind of a memorable way to talk about it. We're constantly shifting spaces, and we shift spaces whenever we tell a new story, or the question of whether we tell our stories is a little bit more complex. I realize I've missed a few comments here, so let me go back and look at those. So Michael says, perhaps the story opening once upon a time makes a move to rise above linear time. Once upon a time is a story from the past expressed in the present for the purpose of bringing meaning into the future. And Ron applauds that. Yeah, I think that's nicely put. I think that you could take it in a little bit, well, you could take it more simply in a sense and just say, this is a great example, that opening. And I don't know how that corresponds to German. But in English, because we have a couple of people who are German speakers here, in English, Once upon a time is the way fairy tales start. And those of you who are familiar with Buddhism know that the way Buddhist sutras start is always, thus have I heard. So there are these kind of formulas for starting a particular kind of story. And you could take the formula once upon a time as signaling a space shift, right? You're entering a new world. And this is a kind of a formal acknowledgement that we're talking about a different world. Maybe the ordinary rules don't apply in this new world, which operated once upon a time, where there's that famous opening of the first Star Wars movie, which I don't remember exactly, but it said something like, once in a galaxy far, far away, right? Once long ago in a galaxy far, far away. It's very much essentially once upon a time. So it's setting the stage. So it actually, now that we're talking about movies, that's another good example. When you start to watch a movie, one of the most important things or what happens is that you're placed in a particular context, a particular setting, right? Something is happening, and there's a kind of an establishing shot, you know, and I think that's what it's called in movie talk, people who make movies, because you have to establish a reality, right? And that's what the story is doing. So you start off a story in that way. Okay, Klaus, I think, says, is storytelling always an alongside event? Well, I'm not sure what you mean by alongside, Klaus. Maybe you could say a little more. If I understand it, we'll be talking about that a little later. But maybe you could say a little more about what you mean by alongside. Well, yeah. Oh, it's Ken. I'm sorry. I just saw Kay here. Okay, Ken. What do you mean by alongside? Oops, you're still muted. I'm anticipating you're speaking up because you are one of the few people who speaks up. You're still muted. You have to unmute yourself somehow. Or maybe Kathleen can do it for you. Okay. Oh, Right. Yeah. Okay, so let me repeat that because I don't think it won't be in the recording. Is storytelling a way to conjure up another stream, another possibility alongside our ordinary reality? You know, the way I would think about it, and if you think about it in terms of space shifting, is that it's not so much alongside, it's a shift, you know, it's a jump. It's like, you know, you're, let's imagine you have several streams running side by side. You have to, you know, and there are stones in the streams and you jump from one stream to another, something like that. So the story would be kind of the stone. okay. So that is in the first, I'm sorry, I didn't recognize that reference from the first TSK book. Okay. And Michael says, upon, as in once upon a time, I guess, feels like an invitation to our stories to float upon time, like an arc of meaning that is not confined to one particular time. Yeah, that's nice. I think, you know, we see it in fairy tales, right? And there is something about fairy tale time that is special in that sense. It's like, oh, we're now entering a world where the usual rules don't apply. And Lee says the universal particular. Yeah, the universal unique, actually, I think Rinpoche says in some places. That's interesting. It's a world of all possibilities. Maybe you could say it that way. Hayward says, to challenge science evokes resistance. Perhaps we can point to the time-space knowledge intrinsic to all scientific investigation, how things appear when known that way. Well, Hayward, I think you're right, and I know you've made this point before. We don't want to present TSK as saying, we have this weird new way of understanding things that doesn't fit with anything else, you know, or doesn't fit with the usual scientific view. And I do think you could talk about time, space, and knowledge as intrinsic to all scientific investigation. But then you'd still at some point have to really talk about how time and space are understood very differently from what we do. The way that I was trying to avoid making it to avoid stimulating that resistance was to say that a TSK view is, it doesn't reject the scientific view, but it does reject the tendency to say that only objective reality counts as really real, and subjective reality doesn't. The TSK is interested. You know, we don't even want to say it has a broader view of reality, because you're right. You know, it never helps to put people down and say, oh, you have a very limited view. You know, that's not so useful. But to say that it's interested in a broader range of possibilities, let's say. Okay, Lee, you're still commenting on this universal particular, I guess. So Lee says, as I understand it, Alfred North Whitehead does this in Process and Reality. So I don't know if universal particular comes from Process and Reality. I've kind of glanced at that book, but I certainly haven't read it. I'm sorry. Lee was commenting on Hayward. So, I think you're right. Yeah, well, you obviously know more about it than I do. That the time-space knowledge dimensions are intrinsic in scientific investigation. I think that's good. People have often said there are interesting parallels between Whitehead and TSK. I've never really had the chance to explore them. And then Klaus says, we should be aware that the whole time we do what we talk about, tell stories. So are you saying right now in the, as we're talking right now, we're telling stories about what's going on? That's absolutely true. You could also say more broadly, there's an issue whenever we try to talk about anything. We're telling a story. And one of the interesting questions, I think we'll get to it more next week when we talk about thoughts, is that we start off by telling, well, let's talk about it in terms of stories. We start off by telling a story, but then at a certain point, there's a kind of a shift. And I was wondering when you said alongside, Ken, whether that was what was involved. You're telling a story, and then suddenly you're inhabiting the story. So, okay, yeah. Well, that's right. That's right. When the story becomes the meaning or the world that you're inhabiting, then that's it. It's now your reality. And so the question is, is there a shift? And maybe you could talk about that in terms of alongsideness. But you could certainly talk about it, I would say, in terms of telling and living, or telling and inhabiting the story. And I think an example of that you may be familiar with is dreams. I don't know if this is true for everybody. It's not something I notice all the time, but from time to time I've noticed that the way that I enter into a dream is that it starts off as telling somebody something, and then suddenly I'm in it, and that's my reality. So, yeah. Right. So things happen that cause the world, the story, let's say, to shift. So hearing jazz is the example you're giving, is an example. But, you know, so many things are like that. The space shifts all the time. And I do want to mention that, there's something else from Lee here. Yeah, okay. And it's commenting on Hayward. I do want to mention that this gets talked about in the essay that we're kind of roughly referring to, this essay on space fields on page 101 of the essay. He talks about how the field is always shifting. I guess maybe I'll look at, I'll just look at the third paragraph on 101. I don't imagine people have it handy, but I'll read it to you. Perhaps similar changes, you're talking about how space and time change, can change radically. There can be dramatic instances of that. And then he says, perhaps similar changes occur often without our taking cognizance of them. Our experience of time, space, and knowledge may alter from moment to moment. Shifts in mood and outlook already allowed for but dismissed as only subjective might point toward changes that affect the field structures themselves, as though the operative law of gravity could suddenly be repealed. And yeah, it's very nice. And I think, you know, Rinpoche talks in various places in the TSK books about gravity. He's got an interesting way of talking about it. I think in terms of what we're saying now, with in terms of the story giving meaning to the field, giving, you know, putting us in a space, in a world, but in the space of that world. Gravity is like the force that holds it all together. I think that's the way that he's talking about gravity, you know. And so when you space shift, you're entering a new gravitational field. But whatever space you now enter, whatever meaningful world you now enter, there is this force that holds it all together, which has to do with the meaning that the story assigns. But it's I think Rinpoche is referring to that as a kind of gravitational field. We enter that field. Everything works together. You know? So there's actually a wonderful example. I won't try to tell you the whole story at all. There's a movie called The Crying Game, which was it came out about 10 years ago or maybe a little more. If you care to look at it, it's a very interesting movie. But you have, in that movie, you are led to have a certain understanding of the way things are. And then at a certain point, everything shifts. There's a kind of dramatic revelation. And what the director does is he then takes you back into the same place that you were and you thought you knew exactly what was going on, and now everything looks different. Still the same place, but suddenly everything looks different. And because it's a movie, I think he can kind of subtly show you how different things are. We want to get to the point where we can do a little bit of practice. Michael says that quote, I guess the quote I was reading, right, from the space field essay, that quote seems to underscore how the field of our experience does not rest on anything substantial or even external to our subjective viewpoint. Yes, that's absolutely right. The story shifts and everything shifts. Now, most of the time, you know, virtually all of the time, the founding story stays intact. You know, the founding story, here I am. It's as though whatever story we create, we do it in such a way that the founding story stays a part of the story. Something like that. Not that it's always in our minds, of course, but I think it stays. It would be possible, and this is something that Rinpoche talks about in different places, and we all know it, it's possible to shift spaces deliberately, or at least try to. So if we take your example, Ken, of, you know, you're walking along, you're feeling bummed out, you're feeling unhappy, and then you hear some jazz being played and it shifts your mood. Well, you might decide, you know, you're feeling unhappy and you say, well, I'm going to put on some music. I'm going to play some music for myself so that I can shift my mood, right? Or, I mean, that's kind of still trying to externally shift it. You could try to shift it internally. You could, you know, you're feeling unhappy and you could say, I'm just going to tell myself I'm happy. Rinpoche gives that as an exercise and not in the TSK books. He just, he says, just say to yourself, I'm happy, damn it. but much more often what happens is something triggers a change, right? You see something, you hear something, you see somebody. And it may also be that, that being in a certain setting, you know, like maybe, you know, you, there's a place in your, where you live where every time you walk by it, let's say something is broken. And so every time you walk by, you think about how you have to fix it. And for a moment, you're thinking about, well, I have to go to the hardware store and get this. And then you keep walking and you forget about it, you know. And then the next time you walk by, the same thing happens. You know? So all sorts of things can trigger these space shifts, right? And I actually saw something the other day which I thought was kind of nice. You know, there's this interesting movement afoot, or there's an interesting technological development about virtual reality. It's really kind of on the edge of coming into its own, where you can really inhabit a world. You know, you wouldn't confuse it for reality, but it is, it's not just that it's three-dimensional, like a 3D movie. It's three-dimensional in the sense that you're in the middle of it. So if you turn around behind you, you're still in the middle of it, you know. The New York Times happened to send me this little device which will let you do that. It's made out of cardboard. It's actually called Google Cardboard, and the New York Times uses it. But and it's pretty remarkable. I mean, it's still kind of a gimmick, but it is amazing because you really inhabit this different space. But in fact, that's just an illustration of what we're talking about now. It's just the technology has given us a way to do something comparable. But what I noticed was that virtual reality enthusiasts don't talk about reality and virtual reality. They talk about current reality. And I think that's kind of a nice way of thinking about it. You know, here we are. So let's do a practice. You know, I've been talking a lot and trying to lay this out. I want to do a practice for a few minutes, and then I do want to make a point. But let's do the practice and see how people respond. And the practice is extremely simple. The simplest practice you could do to explore this is just let your mind go, let it be free to do what it does, and just see if you can track shifts in space. So we're just going to look in our own experience to see some examples of space shifting. And you know, just remembering something would be, and it could be, probably will be an example of space shifting. Planning something could be an example. Many possibilities. So let's just do that for a few minutes, and we'll see what people, how people experience that. Okay. I know that wasn't much time. I think this whole process of inhabiting or shifting spaces is tremendously interesting. You know, it's something you can do all the time because we're always shifting spaces. So we didn't do it for very long, but it's a place to start. So Hayward says, while space shifts, knowing is always present. Different content with space shifts, but always the light of knowing. Well, that's interesting. That's very interesting. It's where it's actually, I want to go there in a way because, well, I won't go there yet. Let's see what else people have to say. I will add something, a couple of things that occurred to me, but I'm really just kind of holding space open for other people to comment. One, I guess, does relate to what you just said, Hayward, and that is that sometimes you don't realize that you've shifted spaces until afterwards. It's only in retrospect, only looking backwards. And that's just the kind of it's one way of talking about the very standard observation that you lose track of what's going on in your mind. So you realize that you were thinking about something, but while you were thinking about it, you didn't realize it. You come back. And so that's kind of the flip side, Hayward, of what you're saying. Knowing is always present, but we may lose our connection to knowing. That may be one way of saying it, right? But yeah, I mean, in retrospect, you'd say, well, yes, knowing had to be present because there it was. I saw, but as a kind of a living dynamic within our experience, we may or may not be in touch with it. And that's something I want to talk about in just, well, we'll get to it in just a moment. The other thing I wanted to mention is just as an example of the kind of subtle ways in which we shift spaces. You might say, well, okay, if I start off, here I am in the room and I look around and I see objects, and so I'm just inhabiting this space. It's the space of the room. But once you introduce or allow for this dimension of meaning to be present in space, to realize, once you realize space is meaningful, then as you look at space and you kind of track shifting spaces, you realize that just because you're here in the room doesn't mean you're always inhabiting the same space. When I see one thing in front of me, it evokes all sorts of meanings and all sorts of connections. And then if my gaze moves to something else, it's very different. And a good example of that, I suppose, is that not right in front of me, but off to one side, there's a bookshelf. And if I let my eyes wander or go from book to book, certainly just seeing the spine of each book evokes different things. But it's also the case, seeing different people. So, in this moment, part of what people are seeing is different faces on the computer screen, right? So we know each other, or maybe we don't. But seeing each face evokes certain things, Okay. I don't see anybody else commenting. Oh, here's Michael in the nick of time. Each thought brings in some kind of imagined environment, but all those shifts can feel limited to a confined area. The shift to great openness isn't on the menu this morning. That's nicely put. Right, we're not exactly talking about that. We're talking about how we're always moving from one meaningful space to another meaningful space. And if you wanted to go to a well, to great openness, as you say, you'd have to kind of drop down one level, if that's a good way to say it, and say, well, you know, what is going on when this shifting is taking place? You know, what supports and sustains the shifting? And it's related to Hayward's point about the light of knowing always being available. But no, we're getting familiar with space shifting, which is at a certain level. As you say, any space is going to be limited. The founding story is going to be limited. It's going to be confined in a certain way. So, okay, what I want to do in just a couple of minutes we have remaining is make a point that seems to me important and also sets up what we'll be talking about next week. And Michael already did in a way, because he didn't say each story brings in some kind of imagined environment. He says each thought brings in some kind of imagined environment. And that raises the question of, are thoughts stories, or are some thoughts stories? And we'll look at that more, you know, that's kind of a transition to next week. But what I want to say about this issue of stories being confining in a certain sense, and I'm not saying this is what you had in mind, Michael, but it's what I wanted to point to. So as Hayward says, whatever space we inhabit, there's an awareness, or there's the light of knowing. That's always true. Because to inhabit it, we have to be aware in some sense, or, you know, it may not be our awareness, but there has to be an awareness operating. And one way of talking about what happens in TSK is we rediscover our connection to that awareness, you know, by inhabiting space. We have, when space disappears, awareness disappears along with it. And that's part of what brings a quality of joy and presence. So here's the point I want to make, and it may take, you know, next week also to get into this. The story brings meaning into the space that we inhabit. You know, and we're always inhabiting a meaningful space. But we tend to make a characteristic mistake. And it goes to this question. I just referred to the idea that you find in TSK that we've talked about, that space has disappeared. How does space disappear? What's the process through which space disappears? Well, at least one aspect of it is that we trade in space for the story. We tell the story and we try to inhabit the story, but there is no space in the story. The story is just a bunch of words. I mean, I'm not saying it has to be linguistic, but the story is not space. We inhabit a world that is storied, you know, that has been storied out, but we don't inhabit stories. So, you know, maybe a simple example of that is we've worked with breathing in the past, and most of you have probably had more experience in working with breathing. When you really engage the breath, when you inhabit the reality of breathing, you could say, then it comes alive and there's an awareness. But if you say that's what you're going to do when you start off, you probably, like, you're at a distance from it. You're, you know, and you're saying to yourself, well, I'm breathing, right? That's the story. If somebody says, what's going on? And you say something to them. That's the story. It's not the space. It's not the aliveness and the awareness. There's no access to aliveness and awareness from the story. And we make this characteristic move of trying to inhabit stories, or trying to inhabit thoughts. And we'll look at this again in more detail next week. I think I will stop there. Because that's a thought that we need to go into more, but I definitely wanted to introduce it now. And then we'll go into it next week, and I'll also say something about it in the transition. The kind of characteristic move I'm just going to restate it and summarize it. The characteristic move that we make is that we confuse the story with space. I guess I'll leave it at that. Okay, thanks everybody.